You are listening to Smile Politely Radio on WEFT 90.1 FM, Champaign, Illinois.
Welcome to this week's edition of Smile Politely Radio here on WEFT. It is Friday at 5:30. That means we are here. And Smile Politely Radio, tell them what it is, Jason.
Smile Politely Radio, your handy-dandy portable podcast and audio companion to all things Champaign-Urbana. And, of course, your companion to Champaign-Urbana's premier online magazine, SmilePolitely.com. Visit SmilePolitely.com to find out about our handy-dandy little radio show here, plus to contribute your stories about our fair Twin Cities and maybe even join us right here on the radio show.
And that is Jason Brown. My name is John Steinbacher. It is Smile Politely Radio. We are unofficially celebrating our second anniversary this week on WEFT.
Coincidentally, both of us in the studio to celebrate it, too. It's a true occasion.
It is a true occasion. And one of the big reasons this is a good week to celebrate that is one of the original co-hosts of the show, who has since moved on to bigger and better things.
One of the founding players, if you will, of Smile Politely Radio.
Of the show. Mr. William Gillespie is joining us this week.
I'm here. Is this thing on? Yeah. Yep. 2 years. Wow. Yeah. Since we first started this show.
And we'd love to say you just came on to do a roast.
Yeah, right.
But instead, you are actually here because you have done interesting things.
It's true. Unlike me.
Yeah. Don't sell yourself short.
But what we're talking about and what you have done is a novel. You've done several novels, which we can talk about. But you're here to talk about Keyhole Factory, which is being published by Soft Skull Press next Tuesday, November 13th. Is that correct?
That is correct. That's the pub date.
And this this book is a web of stories, which includes a poet astronaut in deep space, a microbiologist contemplating an exit strategy from her high-level job designing biological weapons, a sports car-driving sociopath who murders utopian commune dwellers, and a lone pirate radio disc jockey who believes she is the last person left alive broadcasting her story to nobody. That's a whole lot going on.
Yeah, I tried to find the middle ground between book of short stories and novel. So it is a lot of little stories about different people whose lives intertwine in sometimes obvious, sometimes sneaky ways. So each of the stories is written in a sort of different form from a different point of view during some apocalyptic events that take place more or less near the end of the world as we know it.
And
which I had actually said would be November 11th, 2011, but it took too long for the book to get published. So the end of the world is come and gone.
So you haven't updated that in the book?
No.
Okay. So it's gone from a future version of our world to a slightly different world out there.
Yeah, I don't know exactly what to call it.
Well, let's talk about that since you said, when you originally wrote the book, it was November 11th, 2011. So how long have you been writing this book? From the materials, it seems like it's sort of been 10 years in the making, but it was previously published. This is the first publishing from Soft Skull Press, correct?
The first official publishing. But I started writing it in 2000, although it does incorporate some stories that I wrote before then, but the concept of the book began in 2000. And I started trying to find publishers in 2005. And steeled and inspired by numerous rejections, continued to revise it. And along the way, a small press, Spineless Books, put out an edition of it that has now been canceled in favor of the new shiny paperback from Soft Skull / Counterpoint.
Right, and so this version, is it much different than the Spineless version, or is it pretty similar? Or?
25 fewer typos.
All right.
The beauty of the press.
But the text is very similar.
All right, well, so this is sort of the a vision of the future where, post-apocalyptic kind of, it seems like that's some sort of a subtext going on there. Obviously, that is a very hot topic now. You have shows like, you know, Walking Dead, which is, you know, like the most watched show on cable TV right now, and all kinds of other, not just zombie things, but, you know, The World Without Us, all kinds of things like that. So you said you started writing it in 2000, but have those kind of things inspired you as you've gone along, or did you have this vision in your head? I mean, you know, it's not a new topic, but it's a hot topic now.
Yeah, and I don't know what to make of the fact that the end of the world is really popular, and that even the History Channel has a whole nonfiction TV documentary show about the end of the world, even though it's fiction. But yeah, the actual idea of a apocalypse or plague or end of the world is a fairly old trope, but it has gained a lot of traction in the last decade. I don't know whether this means that the timing is bad for my book because it does not seem original, or whether it's in fact that's why it got published at all, is because of these things.
I think whether it got published at all is irrelevant, but, you know, if it's a hot topic, people are interested in it, so I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing.
Can I just say, though, that this is not a zombie book?
We want to make that clear right up front. Yeah. Right up front.
No zombies.
Unless you're interested in zombies, in which case it is, right?
Well, no. No zombies.
Yeah, I know.
It's a plague. Very scientific.
People don't get the plague and then start eating other people's brains.
They suffer some mental symptoms, but no, they don't eat brains and they die.
Okay. Know? Well, let's talk about sort of the, obviously, as you said, it's a lot of sort of short stories interwoven into sort of a novel format. And flipping through this and having, you know, there's actually a review out there on Smile Politely written by non-related to you, Joel Gillespie, who talks about some of the original formatting and text ideas. And you've got all kinds of interesting pictures in here. And at some point, you know, there's several different kinds of text going on. And there's circular, I don't know how to. I'm not good with book words, but font and stuff like that.
Circular is good.
tell me how that works with the story and where that sort of came from.
Well, the stories use different literary forms and typographic forms. The pictures you're referring to, instead of titles, the stories have little icons that look like sort of international airport symbols. These are mostly taken from a designer named Rudolf Modley, who tried to create a sort of pictographic language. So I'm pleased with that. I don't know of any other book with pictures for story titles, and I probably, you know, beat McSweeney's to that by a matter of weeks. But there are formats, for example, the circles you're talking about, the story is written in the form of little paragraphs that are circular in shape. It's called, its text title is Bubbles, and each of those little circles represents the dying thought of one of the major characters at a time when they're all dying. There's also a story written in columns, starts in one column, continues to two columns, then three columns, then four columns, and this represents the virus being passed from person to person. So as it spreads, the story sort of divides into multiple points of view of people who are infected and don't know it and are doing regrettable things like going to parent-teacher conferences.
Well, you have generously offered to do some readings here, so let's do a quick reading. But before we do that, I want to mention two things. One thing I should have mentioned at the top of the show is that we are going to, at the end of our show, have our new weekly, I don't know if anyone out there listened last week, but we are going to be doing,
I don't
weekly,
know either.
Jason, stop it. We're going to be doing weekly Science Politely segments. These are graduate students at the University of Illinois who are going to be doing segments. And this week, we are our segment is going to be on bees. That's going to be at the end of the show, so stay tuned for that. Second of all, William, you are having a launch event for this book, so give us some details about that real quick, and then tell us what you're going to read.
The launch will be at Bouvon's Wine Bar in the back of the Corkscrew Wine Emporium in Urbana from 6 to 8 on Tuesday the 13th. There will be a cake designed to look like the book, a cash bar, a reading at 7, and a few copies for sale at a discounted price. And you can also go to keyholefactory.com to order a copy from your favorite online bookstore, or try to harass one of our local booksellers into carrying it. And, of course, I would be delighted to sign it for you at Bouvon's Wine Bar Tuesday.
Fantastic. So tell us a little bit about what you're going to read, or maybe it's better just to read it. I don't know.
I'm going to read the first story in the collection, which the text title, the real title is a picture of this band, like a jazz band, and the text title is Central Park in the Dark. It's inspired by a piece by Charles Ives. So go ahead and cue the soundtrack I gave you, which is the NASA Voyager's probes recording of cosmic background radiation. Thank you. Not how you live, not how your friends live, but there it is. TV puts it right on top of you, too close to home. Standing in church, you infuse the worn hymn with new vitality. Other voices attempt to follow the passion you inspire. Afterward, everything is quiet. No crickets in the park. Tranquility, or is it shock? You can't read the weather anymore. The cold winds that happened yesterday, changing directions so abruptly, were unlike anything you had felt. Was the world falling over the edge of something? Was there something we needed to be doing? The sound of a dog nosing a trash can lid in a brick alley raises a scrape in the night. The next morning there is a parade. Sleepily you scratch by your window, peering into the sun. Is it a protest? A march? Or do they want us to bring out our dead? Children with pom-poms and decorated bicycles lead a triumphant crowd, clad in costumes, parkas, colorful hats and scarves, waving flags and bedsheets, delivering no apparent message. In bathrobe and slippers, you walk out on the lawn. The flag that used to hang by your front door is missing. Some of the celebrants grab your elbows and escort you into the procession. You are too groggy to resist, trying not to spill your coffee. Popping noises you thought were firecrackers turn out to be a noise-making contraption designed by a child out of a plastic 2-liter bottle. The people who grabbed you are wearing strange makeup, but you recognize them as neighbors from down the street. Someone has a tray of pot stickers with soy sauce to dip them in, and your priest hands you back a handful of $1 bills. He doesn't explain, but you presume the church is closed and collections are to be dispersed back to the congregation. That night, the strangest noise you ever heard rends the sky. A sawing, almost. It seems as though some oscillation is taking place between east and west horizons. Is it supersonic aircraft? Missiles? Is it a wind that passes overhead without disturbing the air below? As you sleep, it sounds like the sky is caving in above you. You dream of a collision of two winds, each bringing its own weather. In the morning, there is new red gravel scattered about. You go about your day, but seem to have no job to go to. The place is deserted, chained up, locked, the parking lot empty, blinds drawn, altogether foreboding. A small part of you can embrace the idea of not working that day, but you can't just not show up. Wanting to be sure, you climb down into the window well's detritus and find an unlocked window. In an empty building where you used to work, not even the furniture is left. That afternoon, the circus arrives in town in a colorful painted wooden train. In the evening, everyone drifts over to the park. The carousel groans and a calliope blows, but there is a blackout. As you come over the top of the Ferris wheel, it jerks to a stop, making your seat swing unpleasantly, and the strings of lights all through the stands and games and rides and stages and pavilions and radio towers on the horizon go dark. Then silence, save for the creaking of your swinging seat, the wheezing of an incessant accordion, and one kid crying. The carny at the duck chute has a radio, and he turns the volume up, yelling, "The moon! The moon!" People laugh, but look up at the clouds. Somebody uses the word comet, and it spreads through the crowd until everybody is using it. They mean meteor, you think. You want off the Ferris wheel. A clown sends cotton candy up to you on the end of an extensible pole. You take it, but do not eat it. A few shirtless men work to make the Ferris wheel turn so people can get off. They need only to release the engine, and the weight of riders causes the wheel to rotate. They break it, chair by chair, helping each rider off. You are afraid it will come loose from its axle and roll forward, crushing you. As you descend in jerks, you stare at the light passing through a gap in the clouds, black veins and white glass. The calliope is in a different key from the tattooed lady singing "Fly Me to the Moon," but for a moment it sounds like one new music. Only then are you frightened, but it passes. The next night, as the sun sets, you and your neighbors stand on your lawns and turn your backs on it, awaiting moonrise, joking a little, to reassure yourselves that it had been an atmospheric effect. Soon there will be radio stations again, you say, and there is its red arc coming over the horizon.
All right. Well, thank you so much for reading that.
My pleasure.
Going back to the sort of the overall theme for the book, I understand it's got a lot of different layers and things, but sort of this, what interests you in writing about sort of a wasteland or this? You obviously in that passage, it seems like there's this unknowing. Feels like sometimes there's no radio contact. Is that sort of what's going on there?
Yeah.
What interests you in writing? I mean, you get this uneasy feeling sort of in this modern world of not being able to hear stuff. Or at one point you have a woman who is broadcasting over the radio but doesn't think anyone's listening. Is there something under some subtext there that you think you're trying to get out about the modern world or?
Yes, I think so. We talked about the trend in post-apocalyptic movies, literature, TV shows, and even documentaries. And I think there is a fear there, particularly in the wake of September 11th in America, and also Hurricane Katrina, Superstorm Sandy, that disaster is becoming sort of a part of the cultural unconscious and a sense of loss, lack of control over the destiny of the environment, the economy, the population explosion. And I think I surrendered to those fears. One of the things that distracts us from this in contemporary life is being immersed in language and information and great websites like Smile Politely with lots and lots and lots of comments. And at all times, we're completely saturated in language, radio transmissions on dozens of frequencies from cell phones to weft to police radios. And so just the idea of silence, like real total silence, is kind of creepy.
It's very creepy, is there also maybe a little catharsis to that as well, though?
Absolutely.
A little bit of wishful thinking, sort of under the way under the surface.
Yeah, not in a mean way, but
no.
If you sort of look at the story from an environmentalist point of view, the story itself is kind of about a virus that destroys the human race, but it also in some of the layers portrays the human race as a virus that's destroying the planet. So the actual virus is kind of a cleansing bug. So it's in that sense, it's a very happy story for the fate of the earth and the trees.
And how important is it? And I know that this is in here, and I know, knowing you a little bit, I know you're a relatively funny guy anyway, so you probably couldn't help it. How important is it to have a little bit of a sick sense of humor? Or, I know that there's a little bit of humor in this book, and Is that something that just comes out of you naturally, or that you purposely put in the book to sort of keep people moving along in the direction?
Well, it's hard for me to get a bearing on that, but I will say that the second story, The Bad Poet, is sort of intentionally funny, kind of written in a glib style that has been popularized in the past couple decades, and in that sense is entirely misleading. So there's some intentional humor that's right there at the beginning to draw the reader in as a kind of bait and switch. Maybe I shouldn't have admitted that.
You've said too much.
After that, there's things in there I think are funny, but harder to laugh directly at.
Right.
How difficult was it to... you talked about sort of the novel becoming a combination of maybe a short story collection and a novel, and it's doing a number of things at once. How difficult was it, not just the writing, but while writing, structuring it to get to the point of publication, figuring out just how you wanted this whole thing to come together?
Well, in that sense, the fact that I had trouble getting it published was very helpful, because I could keep revising it and...
Constructive criticism along the way, sort of?
A little bit.
Yeah,
a little bit. So I was able to bring in more material and discard some other material that didn't fit. Have either of you read the book Jesus' Son by Dennis Johnson?
I have not. I'm sadly far behind on my reading.
Yeah. I recommend it. I bring it up because it has this magical effect where it's it's this very thin book about some drug-addled miscreants in Iowa and or Seattle, and all the stories are written from the first person, and you can't really tell whether it's all the same guy or not, and that effect is kind of maddening. It's kind of ruined in the movie because they had to, you know, make a call to put Billy Crudup in the lead role. But that's kind of what I was getting at. I don't know if that answers your question, but I wanted to create that befuddlement I felt when I was reading that book.
Mm-hmm.
And when I read the book, I didn't even know, because Dennis is spelled D-E-N-I-S. I didn't know whether it was a woman, Denise, or a man, Dennis. I just didn't have any idea where this book was coming from. And I was hoping to sort of create that effect where, is this a novel or is it short stories? And okay. I don't know whether I succeeded, but I was trying to find that very confusing midpoint between those two genres.
Well, it's a great looking, I mean, the book looks great, and it probably sounds more intimidating than it is the way we're discussing it, because there's only the way you've structured it, there's just passages here and there, and I mean, you could pretty much, you know, it's 300 and something pages, but I'm sure this is not that long of a read, because there's not a whole, it's not densely packed. I mean, the ideas are dense and everything like that, but it's not as intimidating probably as...
It's very accessible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's got a lot of white space, and again, the really weird stuff happens in the middle, because I figure that's when the end of the world actually happens. You're not going to get a very straight narrative like you will for the Civil War or September 11th.
Right.
In the middle of it, some people are going to think it's the Second Coming. Other people are going to, you know, blame the Democrats, and everyone will have their own story of what's going on.
Well, we wish you great luck with this. Tell us again about the launch on Tuesday night.
Bouvan's Wine Bar, 6 to 8 in Urbana. Cash bar, tiny amounts of cake and discounted books. And you can go to keyholefactory.com to find out everything there is to know about the book thus far. It's not even out yet, but Amazon is cheating, and they've started shipping them.
All right, and again, that's Keyhole Factory, a novel by William Gillespie, and I'll just read this real quick. The quote on the cover says, "William is a superstar, David Foster Wallace." So thank you very much, William. We obviously are really wishing you the best of luck here. We think you're obviously a great person. So.
And thanks for being part of our second anniversary celebration
show.
Really
cool.
Yeah.
I'm glad that this you're carrying the torch and keeping this going. And Smile Politely is not that old either, and you're doing a great thing for for this community, sort of increasing the media landscape by a power of 10.
Well, thank you so much. And speaking of increasing the media landscape, as some of you may know, we have a new regular segment going on here. It's called Science Politely. It is a part of a University of Illinois graduate science class outreach program where the students are trying to get better at and communicate with the general public about their projects. So coming up this week, we actually have a previous guest of Smile Politely.
We do. A terrific Polly Nader.
She's known in the world of roller derby, but I believe her real name is Michelle Duenas.
Yeah.
And
yeah. I didn't know that.
She speaks about bees. So here we go.
It's a chilly morning on the first Saturday in June, and I'm in my bee costume at the Urbana Market at the Square. Black and yellow tights with matching gloves, a honeycomb patterned skirt, and pipe cleaner antennae. The adults that approach my booth mostly come to tell me how scared of bees they are, or to ask how to kill the ones that are chewing holes in their deck, which are carpenter bees, by the way. I've been at the farmer's market every Saturday in June for the past 3 years to advertise for National Pollinator Week. Every June, I begin my metamorphosis from Michelle Duenas, graduate student studying the evolution of bumblebees, to Pollinator, champion of bee justice. Why do I do this, you ask? Because I love bees. More specifically, I love bumblebees. I love everything about them. I love their social behavior. I love how they make their own body heat so they can fly when there's still snow on the ground. I love all of the beautiful colors they have around the world. Another reason I love them, and a reason you should love them too, is that they're vitally important to our food system. Without the crucial pollination they provide, we wouldn't have peppers, tomatoes, and lots of other fruits and vegetables. But the real reason I try so hard to raise awareness about bumblebees is because many of them are in trouble, and part of the reason is our fault. Bumblebee species are introduced into non-native areas through commercial trade for crop pollination, and this can cause a whole suite of problems for the native bees that live there. The way that species interact with their environment is like a complicated puzzle that's been shaped by millions of years of evolution. Introducing a new species to an environment is like trying to cram a piece of a puzzle where it doesn't belong. It's out of place, and it screws up how you assemble the rest of the pieces. Terrestris is a European species of bumblebee that's been used for commercial pollination all over the world for decades and is causing problems, most notably in Japan and Korea, by mating or hybridizing with the native species there. Here in Illinois, we tend to think of hybrids as a good thing. Corn hybrids, for instance, are better at defending themselves from pests and disease. But hybridization can have serious consequences. Think of killer bees or inbred farm salmon mating with wild salmon. When hybridization happens between native bees and bees that were never supposed to be there in the first place, it can decimate the native population. So why are bees that are different species able to mate and hybridize with each other? This is where knowledge of their evolution becomes important. This terrestris can mate or hybridize with the native bees in Japan and Korea because it's closely related to those species. That is, they shared a common ancestor not so long ago. In my research, I studied differences in DNA that can reveal the evolutionary relationships among species. I do this specifically with a Mexican bumblebee species called Ophipiatus. This species is being bred in labs so that it can be commercially available for pollination in Central America. Across Ophipiatus's range in Mexico and Central America, it possesses a wide variety of different colors, which has made some bumblebee researchers question whether or not it's a single species. I'm trying to answer that question by looking at their DNA. The research I've done so far shows that Ophipiatus is at least four different species. One of them lives in northern Mexico. Two others live together in southern Mexico, Guatemala, and Honduras. And the fourth lives in Costa Rica. These species that I've identified within Ophipiatus are much more closely related to each other than the species I mentioned in Japan and Korea that have been hybridizing or mating with the European species Terrestris. if the species from northern Mexico was brought into Guatemala for greenhouse pollination, the chance of it escaping and hybridizing with the native species there is incredibly high. And it's my hope that by communicating what I've learned to the commercial bumblebee companies in Mexico, that they'll safely traffic these bees to prevent invasions and maybe even become a role model for other agribusinesses worldwide. Bumblebees are vitally important to our food system, and our actions can greatly affect whether or not they live or die. If you want to learn more about how you can help bees in our area, participate in all the great events we'll have for National Pollinator Week next June. I'll be the girl in the bee costume. Consistent with the facts. The proof is with science. The truth is with science.